The BioWorld Insider Podcast.
This is the BioWorld Insider Podcast. I'm Lynn Yaffe, BioWorld's publisher. By now, most of you have likely seen the spectacular new images coming from NASA's Webb Telescope. As we're getting new views of the universe, including how it once appeared, so many deep existential questions arise about humanity and our place in the universe. It's super thought-provoking. Interestingly, researchers in the life sciences are also pioneering work related to our existence. Specifically, can we live longer? The short answer is yes, but can we extend our lifespan in a healthy way? That's the critical question. The BioWorld team decided to take a deep dive into the concept of extending lifespan, which is surprisingly well validated by basic research. In our new Extending the Human Lifespan report, BioWorld examined the latest science, the key biological drivers that can be targeted pharmacologically, and the companies developing these potential, dare I say, fountain of youth candidate drugs. What we found is that investments in life-extending drugs and the number of clinical trials are on the rise. But the intent isn't to live forever, just a bit longer. The emphasis is on living longer in a healthy way. And that's important since the global population of people 65 and older rose 468% between 1950 and 2020. Today, we're going to walk through some of the highlights of the Extending the Human Lifespan report. But if you want to read the full report, visit BioWorld, where all the series articles and data are freely available. Annette Brendel, our senior science editor, led the research and wrote much of the series. She'll tell us about why it's a waste of time to try to first cure Alzheimer's, cataracts, strokes, and other diseases of aging. Instead, many forward-thinking scientists are focusing on the biology of aging. Can we hopscotch over those diseases? Karen Carey, our senior analyst, took a data-driven approach. She found that the amount of money investors are putting into the space and the number of clinical trials are on the rise. Staff writer Richard Staines will weigh in on how equitable access to drugs and therapies tackling aging could reduce healthcare costs and improve quality of life. Regulatory editor Mary Serebrov will talk about the many hurdles and blockers related to developing these therapeutics. So let's go ahead. Annette, is it really possible to live longer in a healthy way? What's new on the research front that validates the concept?
Hi, Lynn. It's great to be here. So the short answer is yes, you can live long and prosper. Or at least you can have better odds of living long and prospering. The National Institute on Aging's Interventions Testing Program in animal experiments, but in experiments that are very stringent in terms of making sure that the results are robust and reproducible, has managed to find half a dozen drugs that extend healthy lifespan in one or both sexes in mice. When I started looking into what's going on in anti-aging research, that was one of the big surprises, that it's really quite well validated in basic research that you can extend healthy lifespan. These mice live, in some cases, 30% longer, and they are not, as Richard Miller from the Interventions Testing Program formulated it, they are not these old, decrepit, demented little mice that simply won't die. They live healthily for longer. And we've seen that kind of excitement about anti-aging drugs before. The most recent example was the sirtuins almost 15 years ago or so, and those spawned, you know, sort of a cottage industry and a lot of more or less tongue-in-cheek claims that you could live forever by drinking red wine and eating dark chocolate, if anyone else remembers
that.
And I think what's different now is that in about the last decade, anti-aging research has become much broader and more comprehensive than it historically has been. Almost 10 years ago now, some scientists published a paper on the hallmarks of aging. That's an analogy to the hallmarks of cancer, which have spurred a lot of research and really proved to be a powerful conceptual framework for how cancer happens. And the hallmarks of aging are 9 separate cellular processes that seem to change with age and affect whether you age in good health or become sick. And there's lots still to be learned about which of them are causal and which might be targetable and whether there are others. And whether some of them are more important than others. But the hallmarks sort of give the field a much broader basis for starting to look at what aging means on a cellular and subcellular level, and then from there, how to address them pharmaceutically.
You wrote that anti-aging drugs might simultaneously reduce the risk of multiple age-related illnesses in one. How would that work?
Well, so how it would work on a cellular level is sort of the blockbuster question, right? But conceptually, aging is a major risk factor for just about every chronic disease in the developed world. It's the major risk factor for heart disease, much stronger risk factor than high cholesterol. It's the major risk factor for cancer, certainly for neurodegenerative diseases. And if you think about the pandemic we've all been living through for the last 2.5 years, your risk of dying from COVID-19 increases sharply with age. Your chances of catching COVID are essentially no different whether you are in your 20s or in your 70s. But compared to someone in their 20s, your chances of dying from COVID are 140 times higher if you are over 75 and 330 times higher if you are over 85. So even in those diseases where it's not necessarily age-related whether you get them, right? In infectious diseases, whether you die from them is very much age-related, at least in some of them. So, conceptually, the question is, what's the underlying factor that is driving up the risk for all these diseases simultaneously? And if you could target that, then you should be able to lower the risk of many diseases at the same time. The CEO of Cambrian Biopharma, James Payer, told me that the goal is to develop what he called a multi-morbidity prevention drug. So in terms of the actual cellular mechanisms you could target, there are a lot of possibilities. And like I said, aging science is not a settled thing yet. So in our series, I focus on 2 different possibilities to sort of illustrate how you can go about or how you might go about this. And one is the rapalogs. That's a comparatively old class of drugs that have been validated by the ITP as extending lifespan in mice. And for that class, there's approved therapies on the market. One is a transplant rejection prevention drug, and there are anti-cancer drugs too. So that is one way, that's an approach of taking things that are validated clinically, but not for aging, and validated for aging, but not clinically, and trying to put those things together. Another opportunity is to go for sort of the really cutting edge science that has neither been shown as of this moment to extend lifespan, nor has it been validated clinically, but there's good basic science reasons to believe that it could work to extend health span. And as an example, I use in vivo partial reprogramming. And that's trying to put into therapeutic practice something based on the observation that mature cells can be reprogrammed into a stem cell-like state through a cocktail of transcription factors. So those are the so-called induced pluripotent stem cells. They have become workhorses of biotechnology in cell culture. And Shinya Yamanaka and Sir John Gurdon won the Nobel Prize for their discovery of how to create induced pluripotent stem cells in 2012. That work is still very much at the preclinical stage, but there are several companies that think you can use this principle of partial reprogramming to develop anti-aging drugs. And Yamanaka is a scientific advisor to one of those companies. That's Altus Labs, that launched earlier this year with $3 billion in funding and more Nobelists on their advisory board than most universities have on their faculty. So a lot of money, a lot of star power there. And interestingly enough, Altus does not call itself an anti-aging company, but lots of other people sure do. And the company says it works on cellular rejuvenation, which is pretty much reversing aging on the cellular level. So those are the 2 ways you could go about trying to develop an anti-aging drug. And there's a lot of
people working on each of them, but those are the two examples that I focused on.
It's interesting that we have those two approaches, which really expand the possibilities. Switching gears just a little bit, interestingly, you uncovered a phenomenon that centenarians live longer, not because they're less susceptible to any one specific disease, but because they're less susceptible to all of them. How's that being leveraged in the field of geroscience?
Right. That was one of the fascinating things I learned, that, you know, centenarians seem to live quite well, even though, interestingly enough, they do not really live any healthier than the rest of us. If you look at whether they exercise a lot or whether they have been on the Mediterranean diet since they were 12 years old or never touched a cigarette in their lives, all that doesn't happen. Or all that doesn't seem to play a major role if you look at the statistics. And the main hopeful message from there is that centenarians don't actually incur huge medical costs because they do not seem to get sick. A much more typical thing, if you're going to die at 100, is that you live fairly healthy for a long time, and then you have a brief period of decline. It reminded me of my grandfather, actually, who lived to be 89 years old and then died in his sleep one night, which is, as these things go, really not a bad way to go. And I'm not saying that he never incurred any healthcare costs in his life, but at the time of his death, he was basically healthy and just old. And that's a stark contrast to the overall healthcare spending patterns, where, you know, medical costs just shoot up in the last 2 years of life. And one of the things that people have been afraid of is that if everyone lives to be 100, it will bankrupt any medical system, or that at least it will not save any money, because you still have those high healthcare costs at the end of life. And in front of that, you have 80 years of average medical costs instead of 60 years. And the good news is that that just does not seem to be the case. It's an active area of discussion what the cost consequences would be, but there is some modeling that suggests that you could, by curing things like diabetes, you could extend lifespan, but you could also lower medical costs.
You also found that aging research has the potential to make existing inequities worse by exacerbating gender differences in health span. Talk about that a little bit, please.
Sure. So that was also one of the things that I found fascinating. I knew going into this, like I think probably most people do, that women have the average longer lifespan. What I did not realize, and I suspect most people don't, is that women on the average also spend a longer time in poor health. So their health is worse, but they live longer in poor health. So that's one thing. That was an interesting discrepancy to me in humans. In animals, one of the things I learned that really surprised me and that I still don't understand is that the genes that affect lifespan mostly differ between males and females in mice and fruit flies and animals where people have looked. So there's those two things, and then you combine it with a third thing, which of course is that biomedical research, most of what we know still comes from males. There has certainly been progress on that front, but males for a long time were just sort of considered, you know, the generic human, and then anything that differed between men and women, just you would look at the male and then say, oh, the women are too complicated, we're not going to look at that, you know, hormones, cycles, all this like messy stuff, we're just going to ignore that. So a lot of what we know about aging still comes from the study of males. The interventions testing program of the NIA has been a laudable exception to that. They have been studying male and female mice from the very beginning. And several of the interventions they identified are only effective in one sex. So aspirin extends lifespan in males, but not in females. So if you put all those things together, right, the ITP does this very well. Companies to prevent exacerbating gender differences are absolutely going to have to look at both sexes and at and analyze differences between the sexes in the response to drugs in their interventions, or you risk developing something that is only effective in one sex. And if it's only effective in males, then it's going to exacerbate existing disparities.
That makes total sense. Karen, let's turn to you. Your analysis reveals that the number of clinical trials of therapeutics designed to interrupt the process that leads to life-threatening conditions appears to be increasing, and the amount of money that investors are putting into this space is growing too. So please give us the lowdown on the data.
Thanks, Lynn. Well, the first thing I think you have to look at is what is happening to the market, because that is one thing that really explains the increase of interest in this space. The general consensus is that the market is expanding because people are living longer and we have aging baby boomers. But the data actually back that up, as you've already mentioned. United Nations data show that the global population of those 65 and older rose 468% between 1950 and 2020, but it's also actually expected to climb another 113% by the year 2050. So there is a huge market potential here, not only with slowing the disease process, but in preventing disease, extending lifespan, improving quality of life. We all want these things. In terms of therapeutic development, it is really hard to give a definitive, all-encompassing number of clinical trials currently ongoing. We're definitely seeing the word aging or anti-aging being used more and more alongside certain indications, things like osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, Alzheimer's disease, cardiovascular disease. But if we isolate certain therapies that have been tied into aging, things like metformin, sirolimus, and resveratrol, just taking those three, we can see there are 16 current clinical trials, and actually expanding that into those already completed, Cortellis lists a total of 33. We could go a different direction. If we search for the word aging, we come up with other therapies being studied like alendronic acid, denosumab, donepezil, and zoledronic acid. That gives us another 106 trials for everything from osteoporosis to Alzheimer's disease. We can even do a search for the word senescence, senescence in which a cell loses the ability to divide and grow. Just by looking up that word, we find 26 current clinical trials for things like end-stage renal disease, liver cirrhosis, Alzheimer's, and others. To tell you the truth, though, there are most likely countless more trials that are targeting diseases associated with aging, but they're using different wording, so it makes the search process a little more difficult. Overall, though, these types of efforts are popping up everywhere. Another way we can measure interest in this space is to look at the money. So BioWorld, as you know, tracks all financings from IPOs and follow-ons to private placements and venture capital rounds. But if we look only at VC rounds, we find that as private company financings have hit records in the last few years, more money has poured into companies working on aging diseases. So from the full year of 2020 through early July of this year, there was $1.95 billion raised through 38 financings for private aging disease companies. Now, if we take that figure and we break it down by year, we went from about $350 million in 2020 to $900 million last year to about $700 million already this year, with five more months to go. Now, these are companies that have specifically said they are targeting aging diseases. If we look at all diseases known to be associated with aging, the money would most likely go higher. The other thing to note is a 2000 study by the NIH found that the cost burden associated with six conditions. It was basically chronic lung disease, ischemic heart disease, stroke, lung cancer, pneumonia, and gastrointestinal illness. Those six conditions in people 65 and older, the cost burden was $135 billion, and that's back in the year 2000. So I took note of what Annette just said about how medical costs tend to shoot up the last 2 years of life. But if we extend life, you know, we might have 80 years of average costs instead of 60 years. Looking at that $135 billion, what I found striking is that if I look at our VC rounds just this year involving companies working in those specific areas, I find $1.47 billion raised privately for 27 biopharmas. That is about 12% of all VC money raised in 2022. Now, it's a lot of money, but then when you look at that NIH study, $135 billion, it's actually a very small sum compared to the costs of these diseases on society.
Can I hop in quickly?
Go ahead, Annette.
What I was thinking as you were talking, Karen, is that, you know, the 2022 money clearly doesn't even include Altos Labs, which by itself has $3 billion in funding because they don't consider themselves an anti-aging company. So it is, you know, as you were saying, it is somewhat difficult to figure out. And the estimates that we have are probably something of a lower boundary for how much money is actually going into this.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. It is very hard to pinpoint an exact amount. You know, there are companies working in multiple different areas, and they may not specifically say they're working on an aging disease or they're trying to interrupt aging to prevent a particular disease. It's very, very difficult to know, not only with the clinical trials, how many clinical trials there are, but also to know the full amount of money. But when we're talking about billions instead of millions, you know that it's having an impact.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, a number of these companies don't want to say aging. I was just going to say, Mary probably has something to say about endpoints and aging. So take it away, Mary.
It's not just endpoints, but the other day I was talking with Jan Pullman at Janssen Pharmaceuticals. He's working on some vaccines that target pathogens that are known to be drug resistant. And what he was saying is eventually the hope is that we will come up with a vaccine plan for older adults, similar to what we see for little kids, but just targeting different infectious diseases. And if you could vaccinate, like against hospital-acquired infections, you know, particular types of pneumonia, sepsis, whatever, that would increase life as well and improve health outcomes when people go in just for a routine surgery or something like that. So the vaccines are not going to show up in the financing part of this, but they could play a huge role in extending healthy life.
So let's turn to Richard now. Richard, what if these therapies do make it to market? What would be the benefits to society and patients, assuming that there is equitable access to them?
It's a very big if, but if we can get equitable access to anti-aging drugs. yes, there are some real benefits, which have kind of already been touched on. But this whole idea of the huge cost to healthcare systems of diseases of age, and also obviously let's not forget quality of life of people who've actually got these diseases, it's terrible. So there's a kind of a driver at both a societal and an individual level to try and maybe tackle this?
So there's a strong economic argument, has already been put forward, for early intervention. If we can show that giving someone a medication earlier in their life cuts the chances of severe disease later on. It's particularly true, I feel, in the European model of healthcare, where there are healthcare systems funded either nationally or through insurance or the taxpayer. With these systems, there is a strong incentive to cut costs and actual healthcare activity. So I spoke with Marianne Elizabeth Mertens, a partner at Apollo Health Ventures, which is one of the funds specialising in investing in therapies that tackle ageing. She's argued that we could see healthcare systems evolve as the evidence stacks up in favour of intervening early. The hope is that these medicines or therapies could cut the incidence of diseases of ageing and also the costs associated with them. I would say in the US, where healthcare is less centrally organised, it may be a different story, but people may see the value in self-funding a medicine if they think there's a good chance it will produce a health dividend later in life. And what's also interesting is, as you've already alluded to, the other panellists have alluded to, is metformin is one of the first drugs that's being trialled to prevent diseases of age. Now, this is cheap and readily available. And while I wouldn't want to second guess the outcome of a trial, if an inexpensive, if a cheap, readily available drug were shown to cut risks of diseases such as Alzheimer's, cancer, diabetes and cardiovascular disease later in life, it could certainly appeal to large numbers of people who may find it a worthwhile investment, perhaps on top of trying to adopt a more healthy lifestyle. So to summarise, really, Apollo Health Ventures argues that several factors are now coming together that could see healthcare systems evolve and begin to reimburse or encourage use of anti-aging drugs, whether or not this this is a debate you had about the end point, which we'll move on to soon. And the pressure on the healthcare system is increasing because of an ageing population, as everyone's pointed out. But there's also a better understanding of the pathology and the molecular basis of ageing, as Annette's already pointed out. So overall, this could lead to a shift towards early intervention and prevention of chronic diseases of age.
Thanks, Richard. And you mentioned reimbursement. Let's turn to Mary, because, of course, the buck stops here. Let's talk about how these therapeutics might be regulated, because aging isn't an endpoint. And as a result, many new regulatory and reimbursement approaches are needed. Tell us about that.
Well, going off of what Richard just said, he mentioned metformin. And one of the things with the metformin trial is it's more a proof of concept trial to kind of map out a regulatory path for this. And what I found interesting is that it's focusing on people who are 65 already and older. So it's not looking at starting drugs in people who are 50 or 20 and seeing it forward, because that would take forever to do a trial like that. So it's looking at people who already would be considered old by some measures, even though I personally take umbrage with that. But generally, with drug development, we think of the major hurdles as being preclinical and clinical. Do we have a candidate? Can it meet proof of concept? But in this field, actually, regulatory issues could be the biggest hurdle because of the indication issue. And reimbursement could be a close second. These hurdles will vary country by country because of how they recognize drugs. For instance, in the US, the FDA has the legal authority to approve drugs that are defined as substances intended for use in the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease. And then look at Australia. In addition to that definition, the TGA can consider substances drugs if they promote well-being. And that's a big difference. So if you have to look at an indication as related to disease, some people are saying, well, let's make aging a disease. Well, there's a problem with that, since we all begin aging at birth. And so at what point does age become a disease? Also, not everyone ages biologically at the same time. So you could have a 65-year-old who is very healthy. You could have this, and so it's, they might object to being considered diseased. But then you can have a 65-year-old who has a multitude of chronic illnesses. And I think we have to keep in mind with this, and this is what makes the indication kind of tricky, is that these anti-aging drugs are not trying to stop or reset the chronological clock. The goal is to turn off or delay the arms of the biological clock. There is a big difference there. And the reason the indication is so important is because it dictates the clinical trial endpoints, the size of the trial, and the duration of that trial. So we've got to get that nailed down before we can really advance this field that much more. And so some in the field are pushing to have aging recognized as a significant risk factor for multiple chronic diseases, and Annette spoke to that. George Cuchel, director of the UConn Center on Aging at the University of Connecticut, noted that 95% of people 65 and older have at least one chronic disease, and about 75% have two or more. That makes age the single biggest risk factor for these diseases. That includes cardiovascular issues, diabetes, cancer, and a multitude of other diseases. Now, in the past, the FDA and other regulators have approved drugs to address risk factors such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, blood sugar imbalances, even lifestyle factors such as smoking and obesity. But to approve drugs to treat aging as a risk factor, we have to develop biomarkers. People in the field have been calling for the development and validation of aging biomarkers for more than a decade. But even though regulatory science has evolved considerably over the past 10 years, we're not that much closer to having those biomarkers than we were in 2012. There's a lot more interest in it, perhaps, but the regulators haven't got on board with this as much. So that's one big hurdle that we've got to overcome. The other is reimbursement. And like I said, Richard spoke to this. And again, the challenges with reimbursement are going to be country by country, depending on whether a country has universal health care or whether they have a complex insurance program like the U.S. does. But having a drug that could be transformational is going to be meaningless if payers and government won't cover it. In the U.S., we were reminded of that last year when CMS's coverage decision on all Alzheimer's monoclonal antibodies targeting plaque, even if they had FDA approval, would it be covered under Medicare? So in other words, FDA approval is no guarantee that you'll get reimbursement in the U.S.
But Mary, can't these doctors just, you know, prescribe them off-label?
That doesn't mean they'll get covered. Mm. Medicare doesn't cover most off-label uses, except for in the cancer field. And a lot of private insurers won't cover off-label uses, especially if a drug is expensive. Now, we don't know how pricey these drugs will be. And a lot of it may depend on when they start having to be administered, too. I know with the metformin example that Richard mentioned, metformin is a dirt cheap generic. But not all the drugs that come down this path will necessarily be generics. And that doesn't mean the price would remain dirt cheap if they were approved for this.
Exactly.
Yeah. One reason the FDA and CMS decisions differ is because FDA approval has to be based on the benefit safety profile of a drug, whereas the CMS coverage decision has to consider whether use of the drug is reasonable and necessary. So you have to get buy-in from CMS as to whether these drugs really will present a benefit. So you may have to have different evidence from clinical trials to convince them of that. And one reason CMS is so important is a lot of the private insurers follow the CMS example. But then, speaking of private insurers, if you have drugs that have to be started earlier in life to develop this benefit later in life, you can have private payers balking at covering them because they're not going to see that financial benefit. Because by time a person is healthier in their older years, they're going to be on Medicare or with a different insurance plan. There also are challenges for countries that use health technology assessments to determine whether to cover a drug and at what price they could handle. And part of the problem with this is many of their drug assessments are based on drugs that are similar to ones that are already on the market. It's easy to make an assessment for a drug like that. But assessing a drug in a totally new class for a totally new indication, especially when all the evidence may not be available yet, could be a challenge for some of these assessment boards. And then you've got individual countries having to face the question of how best to invest their limited health resources. And this could really be a big issue in poorer countries. Poverty is the second biggest risk factor for chronic diseases. So poorer countries could benefit the most from aging drugs, but can they afford these drugs for their entire population? That could be a big question for them. And the resulting discussion could trigger all kinds of socioeconomic debates. For instance, will having a healthier, older population affect such things as retirement, employment opportunities for younger people, the balance of services a country is expected to provide? I mean, there are a lot of discussion issues here that will go well beyond health, life sciences and health. And I think, you know, we're just starting to touch on those issues that these governments will have to consider.
Indeed. And my takeaway from what you just told us is that it all comes back to the equitable access portion. And the first thing that came to mind is, oh, well, only the millionaires might be able to afford this in the beginning before insurers and regulators buy in. But maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit.
Well, that's something that Dr. Kuchel discussed. He said it's great to have that investment, but it has led to this misperception that we've got billionaires looking to extend their lives. And he says that is not what's going on. The benefit will be to poorer people as long as they get the drugs. And that's why the TAME trial is focusing on using a drug like metformin that is so cheap because they want to make this affordable for everybody.
That's encouraging. I want to bring it all back to Annette for a final remark. Annette, I know this is a very complex topic, but what is the most important takeaway about this research and the whole idea of extending our healthy lives?
So I would say that I came to this story or the series sort of a skeptic. You know, and like a lot of people, like Mary has said, you know, there's this perception that it is about billionaires trying to live forever. I'm sure there are some billionaires out there trying to live forever. But in the bigger picture, really, anti-aging research has transformative potential. And like Mary pointed out, you know, the folks who could benefit most are the ones who are poor. And so anti-aging research has this transformative potential, but the nitty and gritty of it has a lot in common with other drug discovery. So James Payer, the Cambrian CEO who I talked to for this story, really hit the nail on the head, in my opinion. He told me that anti-aging research has been done a disservice because of the conflation of two things. And one is what these drugs, you know, or any drugs can reasonably be expected to do about aging. And then the other is the sci-fi notion that humans have, you know, that they want to beat death. Immortality is a pipe dream and it will remain a pipe dream, but healthy aging is this vibrant field of research with lots of potential and with plenty of people doing rigorous research. also some not so rigorous research, which we talk about a little bit in the series as well. But really, I mean, the larger part of it, you know, there's a large part of it that is really not head in the clouds, but has a real chance of going somewhere. And I guess I'm, you know, to really bring it back, I'll go back to my grandfather, you know, dying at home in his sleep at the age of 89, which is the opposite of how way too many people die in the era of high-tech medicine. And these drugs that folks are trying to develop, they're not going to make us immortal, like I said, but that trajectory of a long, healthy life followed by, you know, a relatively brief period of decline, I think we can substantially increase the odds of that for many people. And that is really what the field is trying to do.
Annette, Richard, Karen, and Mary, this has been a fascinating discussion, which we'll likely revisit many times as we all grow older together, pumping out the news about these kinds of amazing innovations in therapeutics for humans. As always, BioWorld will continue to keep you informed of all the most important scientific, clinical, and business updates. That's our show for today. If you need to track the development of drugs, turn to BioWorld.com, follow us on Twitter, or email us at newsdesk@BioWorld.com. Also, if you're enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe. Thanks for joining us.
BioWorld, published by Clarivate, is a subscription-based news service, but all of our COVID-19 content, more than 7,000 articles and data entries since the start of the pandemic, are freely accessible.